Late last winter, I was feeling pretty blue about something or other. I don't know what. That didn't seem right at the university. And I found myself wondering whether it was worth it. Sound familiar to you? As is so often the case with really, truly monumental matters, I have no idea now what that was. But whatever it was, it made those winter days a little darker than usual. That led to a question that I found myself literally and truly asking myself. I don't know whether it was out loud, but it might have been. In the darkened study of the president's home one night, the question, should the church even have a university at all? Did it justify the effort? It's interesting enough, the commissioner and I haven't colluded on our remarks, but he knew the theme and so did I. Did it justify the effort, the expense, the toil, the tithing? Was it worth the pain? After all, the church had disengaged from a number of operations, which included not only hospitals and hotels, but of far more interest to us, it included schools. Should the church, I wondered, continue to fund BYU if resources are limited and an increasing number of students cannot attend, and if individuals at the university, or in any way the universe collectively, somehow would not measure up to the expectation that so many generations have had for us? I sat there that night thinking of what I said on August 26, 1980, exactly 8 years ago this week, when you were kind enough to sit through the very first of these messages from me. I said then that I was gambling everything I had in whatever the Holland administrative years would be on one single preeminent principle. That cardinal supposition, that one consuming vision, was that we could be an excellent university, indeed a truly great university, an educational Mount Everest, if you will, and still be absolutely, unequivocally, forever faithful to the gospel of Jesus Christ and His restored church, which sponsors us. In fact, we would accomplish the one because of the other, never in spite of it. My presidential belief, the only one that seemed to me to justify BYU's existence, was that we could have it both ways. That superb scholarship and rock-solid faith were as inextricable in our future as they were essential to it. I spoke that day of scholar saints who could make this university one of the latter-day wonders of the world. Now, from that first meeting to this very hour, I have believed that such idealism, such passion for the ultimate possibility was incumbent upon every one of us, certainly incumbent upon me. It's but a base, ignoble mind that mounts no higher than a bird can soar, Gloucester reminded Suffolk. I believed we could somehow, some way, mount higher, and I was certain God expected our minds to soar. Henry Thoreau had mused by the side of his woodland pond that in the long run men hit only what they aim at. So not failure, but low aim would be the most severe indictment of a Latter-day Saint fortunate enough to be at BYU. Surely, we of all people are moved by that indomitable urge, that's Ortega's phrase, that indomitable urge to expand life, to enlarge it, to improve it. That is our hope, that's our theology, that's our heritage. From the beginning, ours has been a soul-stretching belief. Thy mind, O man, said the prophet Joseph Smith, if thou wilt lead a soul to salvation, must stretch as high as the utmost heavens, and search into and contemplate the darkest abyss and the broad expanse of eternity. Only then, he said, could we contemplate the mighty acts of Jehovah in all their variety and glory. Close quote. The mighty acts of Jehovah. I have believed that BYU should be one of the mighty acts of Jehovah. to be less than that for his purposes and his people seemed to me a blasphemy. With such aspirations, then, for all of us, I suppose it isn't surprising that sometimes in the dark of the night, I feel we're not measuring up. Soaring is, after all, difficult work. And yes, I did remember that Nauvoo, the city of Zion, had been laid out to feature two great Latter-day Saint monuments, a temple and a university. But I also knew that scholastic tension between the sacred and the profane had marked most of this world's history. And if the dream weren't really attainable, then why have a BYU at all? The fraction of the church's youth we can serve decreases dramatically every year. We have a fixed BYU student numerator and an exploding church membership denominator. So the only challenge we can ever address is the qualitative one. And if we can't win that war, if Jerusalem really can't find and fellowship and seal Athens firmly into the family group sheet, then let's stop holding all those cottage meetings in Provo. Would it not, I wondered, be better to use the tithing resources of the church in a much more fundamental way? Missionary work or temple building or humanitarian aid, for example. And let our students attend any other of 1,000 universities which don't pretend to such millennial aspirations. If BYU were to ever look and act just like any other university, who needs it? Not, I was certain, the tithe payers of the church. Those are very dark thoughts. But I've learned that most thoughts at 1 or 2 in the morning are pretty dark. Thank heavens for sleep. The Lord knew what he was doing when he put a night between 2 days. But back to the study in the president's home. Thanks to my wife, I long ago established the habit of reading at least some scripture every night before retiring, however late. So after such dark thoughts, I turned the lamp back on and reached for the scriptures. For whatever reason, I decided not to pursue the sequential reading that I do most nights. I simply felt to open the scriptures at random and find something fresh and unfamiliar. Now, I don't believe that every time anybody opens a scripture, it's necessarily an inspired act. That is, for that particular verse, probably an act, inspired act to open them. Sometimes it is, but I'm equally confident that sometimes it isn't. Certainly those evenings when my book has fallen open to the Book of Numbers or the Bible Dictionary, I've felt less inspired than others. But this night I opened the book without prejudice and with, I think, a special measure of hope in my heart. Literally and truly, the first words on which my eyes fell were these, in section 97 of the Doctrine and Covenants. Behold, I say unto you, concerning the school in Zion, I, the Lord, am well pleased that there should be a school in Zion. Those words hit me like a jackhammer. I chilled, I blushed, I chilled again, I stood up, I walked around the room. I'm not embarrassed to tell you I was emotional. You know that about me, you would have assumed it. I blubber if the sun comes up. There, across the street, just a few yards from our home, I thought I saw the statue of Carl G. Mazur smile. Carl actually wears a rather stern look most of the day there atop his pedestal. And for all I know, he smiles every morning at 1:30, just to relax, probably. But I hadn't seen him do it before. So I took something of a lightning strike that night, and I almost felt the need to apologize. Lord, I don't really harbor doubts about why we have BYU, even on the bad days, Lord. Think of it as a joke, kind of a joke there on my neighbor, President Mazur. Please don't garnish my wages or my salvation. Don't send me off on horseback with Brother Clough to seek for Zarahemla. I even considered singing the school song. There has to be a school in Zion, you idiot. Because there can be no Zion without it. At that moment, I suspected that even the Brigham Young statue was smiling. Now, I know that the school referred to in Section 97 is technically not BYU. But BYU is, nevertheless, a legitimate academic descendant of the School of the Prophets. And I got a pat on the backside that night, which suggested I stop whining and go to work. There was an inheritance to be claimed. So today, I stand before you a repentant man. And I presume now for a few moments to answer in some detail my own dark, fleeting question. I would like to suggest why I think the Lord is well pleased that there should be a school in Zion, and why His servants have kept a Brigham Young University when almost all other church academies are gone, why I think we need it yet, and why I am committed more than ever to its rightful destiny, a university worthy to be placed before the all-searching eye of God. As I've already said, the most conspicuous and fundamental reason for a school in Zion is plainly and simply because of our theology. You know the verses. Do the work of printing and selecting and writing books for schools in this church, that little children may receive instruction before me as is pleasing unto me. And I assume we're all little children in His eyes. Teach ye diligently, and my grace shall attend you, that you may be instructed more perfectly in things both in heaven and in earth, and under the earth, things which have been, things which are, things which must shortly come to pass, a knowledge of countries and of kingdoms. Seek ye out of the best books, words of wisdom. Seek learning even by study and also by faith. Study and learn, and become acquainted with all good books and with languages, tongues, and people. Such knowledge, we were taught, would rise with us in the resurrection. And the most sobering of all was the warning, it's impossible for a man or a woman to be saved in ignorance. For the glory of God is intelligence, or in other words, light and truth. And light and truth forsake that evil one. I will return to that line later. So part of the message of the restored gospel of Jesus Christ, part of the light now shining in what had been dark ages indeed, was the divine counsel that to be learned is good if we hearken unto the counsel of God. Surely the most powerful and compelling of all the glorious principles to re-enter the world by way of Palmyra was the doctrine of inherent deity. Dare we think it? Could we possibly say it? Would we be labeled blasphemers and heretics for believing it? That we are all literally the spiritual offspring of God, His rightful daughters and sons, who through a kind of divine DNA and the atoning mediation of that greatest of all heirs, the Lord Jesus Christ, have been given the chance to somewhere, someday, by diligence and obedience, that's the line from 130th section, to know what God knows and do what God does. From those humble first beginnings in Fayette to the magnificent finality of the Follett sermon, the prophet Joseph kept rolling back the firmament, kept letting us glimpse, however myopically, into the vast expanse of our own eternity. God has created a man with a mind capable of instruction, he wrote, and a faculty which may be enlarged in proportion to the heed and diligence given to that light communicated from heaven to the intellect. No wonder we would be ardent seekers after knowledge, as President George Buchanan described the Latter-day Saints. No wonder we would be the inseparable friends of truth. No wonder Joseph would leave this warning, a man can be saved no faster than he gains knowledge. Now it would be axiomatic that some truths would matter much more than others. But an educated Latter-day Saint mind would know that. And having circumscribed all truth into one great whole, it would order and integrate and prioritize truth, mixing knowledge with virtue and love and the ordinances of God. In reflecting on the atrocities of the Holocaust, George Steiner once observed, "We now know that a man can listen to Bach at sundown, read Goethe in the evening, and the next day gas his fellow men." What grows up inside literate civilization that seems to lead to barbarism? What grows up, he says, is information without knowledge, knowledge without wisdom, and wisdom without compassion. Close quote. So a Latter-day Saint would listen to Bach at sundown, read Goethe in the evening, and the next day die for his fellow men, if it were necessary. The Lord requireth the heart and a willing mind, Joseph said. Your mind and your heart must expand together, he stressed. You must enlarge your souls toward each other with that unique LDS definition of soul. Let your hearts expand as you learn. Let them be enlarged towards others. The heart and a willing mind. And what of Brigham Young? The longer I live and the more I read, the more fitting I find that this largest and nearly last remnant of the academies, established under his pioneer leadership, still bears and perpetuates his name. As his advocate, our own Hugh Nibley, says, there never was a man more undeviatingly consistent and rational in thought and utterance. Brigham Young's principal schoolmaster was his beloved Joseph Smith. Of Joseph, he said, he took heaven, figuratively speaking, and brought it down to earth. And he took the earth and brought it up and opened up in plainness and simplicity the things of God. And that's the beauty of Joseph's mission. How plain was that view of life? How simple? To Brigham Young, quite simple. What are we here for? Brigham asks and then answers, as he so often did. To learn to enjoy more and to increase in knowledge and experience. The object of this existence is to learn, he said. How gladly would we understand every principle pertaining to science and art and become thoroughly acquainted with every intricate operation of nature. What a boundless field of truth and power is open for us to explore, he went on. We're only just approaching the shores of the vast ocean of information that pertains to this world, to say nothing of that which pertains to the heavens. His metaphor for life was the academy. The treasures of the earth, he wrote, are merely to provide us with room and board while we're here at school, being made for the comfort of the creature and not for his adoration. They are made to sustain and preserve the body while procuring the knowledge and wisdom that pertain to God and his kingdom, in order that we may preserve ourselves and live forever in his presence. And when we've lived millions of years, continuing the quote, in the presence of God and angels, shall we then cease learning? No. Or eternity ceases. We shall never cease to learn unless we apostatize. Can you understand that? He would bellow. Obviously, that kind of effort would be a struggle. But it was a struggle Brigham Young was always willing to ask. He must have anticipated all the demands on our time at BYU in the 1980s. Stay anxiously engaged, he says. Actually, what he said is this. After suitable rest and relaxation, there's not a day, hour, or minute that we should spend in idleness, but every minute of every day of our lives, we should strive to improve our mind and to increase our faith in the Holy Gospel. The more knowledge the elders have, the better. Close quote. And of course, for him, knowledge meant knowledge of everything. This is the belief and the doctrine of the Latter-day Saints, he said. Learn everything that the children of men know. Every true principle, every true science, every art and the knowledge that men possess, or that they ever did or ever will possess, all of that is from God. We should take pains and pride to rear our children so that learning and education of the world may be theirs. Teach the children. Give them the learning of the world and the things of God. Mothers, we will appoint you to a mission to teach your children their duty. And instead of ruffles and fine dresses to adorn the body, teach them that which will adorn their minds. We're trying to teach this people to use their brains, he would plead. Whatever duty you're called to perform, take your brains with you and apply them to what is to be done. Apparently, he'd had an experience or two where some may have forgotten that. In things pertaining to this life, this is his quote, in things pertaining to this life, the lack of knowledge manifested by us as a people is disgraceful. I have seen months and months in this city when I could have wept like a whipped child to see the awful stupidity of this people. Close quote. Wonder how he really felt about it, but... but that was the pain of a prophet, not a pedagogue. He knew why we needed to be intelligent. All our educational pursuits are in the service of God. For all these labors are to establish truth on the earth, that we may increase in knowledge, wisdom, understanding, in the power of faith and in the wisdom of God, that we may become fit subjects to dwell in a higher state of existence and intelligence than we now enjoy, here or hereafter. If men would be great in goodness, they must be intelligent, he would sigh, and say to any who would listen. It was theology. But surely one need not have a school in which to learn. No, and many didn't, including Joseph and Brigham. But they knew that made it harder and maybe a lot less likely. They wanted structure and synergism for their young scholars. They needed, in short, a place in which to assemble and intensify their education. Ergo, reason number two, they needed a school in Zion, like we need BYU. It may be too much to call ourselves Zion in the 1980s, but we can be a place of gathering, not only for an academic family five times the population of the southern Utah city in which I was born, but a gathering place for, in Brigham Young's phrase, the knowledge and treasures surviving in the earth from every age and culture. Now, immediately after arriving in the valley, President Young initiated just such a gathering. Secure at least one copy of every valuable treatise on education, he told the saints. Every book, map, chart, diagram that may contain interesting, useful, and attractive matter. To gain the attention of children and to cause them to love to learn to read. This would include, he said, every historical, mathematical, philosophical, geographical, geological, astronomical, scientific, practical, and all other useful and interesting writings. The business of the elders of this church, he said, is to gather. Gather up all the truths in the world pertaining to life and salvation, to the gospel we preach, to mechanisms of every kind, to the sciences and to philosophy, wherever they may be found in every nation, kindred, tongue, and people, and bring it to Zion. All science and art belongs to the saints, and they must rapidly collect the intelligence that is bestowed upon the nations, for all this intelligence belongs to Zion. All the knowledge, wisdom, power, and glory that have been bestowed upon all the nations of the earth from the days of Adam till now, I'm still quoting, must be gathered home to Zion. And of course, gathering the stuff of learning, the things of learning, or even the students of learning, that was not enough. So reason number three, what any true Zion would need, and the present world needs more than ever before, are those educated and spiritual and wise who will sort, sift, prioritize, integrate, give some sense of wholeness, some spirit of connectedness to great eternal truths. At the turn of the 20th century, Josiah Royce, writing about the great intellectual achievements of our time, observed that man has, quote, through the richness of the intellectual quest, become more knowing, more clever, and more skeptical. But we have not, Royce warned, become more profound or more reverent. Nor have we found a way to put our learning in the context of the eternal. Close quote. Everyone in this room knows, as well as I do, that from Royce's very hour to this, the problem with higher education has been the perpetuation, indeed the intensification, of dividedness, separateness, departmentalization, specialties, subspecialties, and subspecies of subspecialties. Universities in this nation are informational Nagasakis, higher educational Hiroshimas. The watchmen on the tower cry out for those who will integrate, coalesce, clarify, give both order and rank to important human knowledge. This generation, it seems to me, may have students who will not dare to ask the great human questions because their answers appear to be somewhere in the bottom of an academic dumpster, one nearly exploding from the seams of curricular cramming. The connectedness of things is what the educator must pursue, said Mark Van Doren. No human capacity is great enough to permit a view of the world as simple. But if the educator does not aim at that view, no one else will, and the consequences are dire when no one does. Close quote. So I'm convinced that the Lord needs a school in Zion now, even more than a century ago, to help a generation, indeed to help an entire church membership, sort through much intellectual nonsense that is inevitably in an inert swamp of facts. More than any time in our human history, our students need, like a Matthew Arnold needed, a Latter-day Saint Sophocles to teach them, to whom they would gladly give special thanks, the quote is Arnold's, special thanks for an even balanced soul who saw life steadily and saw it whole. Is not BYU this restored gospel's designated place to see life steadily and see it whole? Shouldn't it be here that no less an intellect than Albert Einstein could find what he called that vivid sense of the truly beautiful, that vivid sense of the morally good? Could that not be one of the functions of the Zion of the mind, as Professor Alan Bergen referred to the university in light of his own conversion to the church and decision to come to BYU? A place not only to love the truth and gather it, but a place to organize it and integrate it as well. A place for connectedness, for true community. A place for even balanced souls. But as I make this appeal to us, I make it to myself, to help our students and ultimately to help our church, help the world for that matter, I fear that we can hardly help ourselves toward such wholeness and integration. Whether we are plumbers or professors in this room, clerks or clinicians, we find it very hard to transcend our departments and our specialties. Heaven only knows we find it hard to transcend the trivia of administration. Let me use a homely example. Last year, in this very setting, I referred to a book on education, which has since been on the New York Times bestseller list, hardcover and paperback, for more than 60 weeks. I said then that it was perhaps the most unlikely best-selling book of modern time, filled with philosophy and erudite allusions, written on a dull subject like the responsibility of university presidents and professors. Whoever else might be interested in such matters, and apparently a surprising number are, the provocative title, The Closing of the American Mind, and the even more provocative subtitle, or How Higher Education Has Failed Democracy and Impoverished the Souls of Today's Students, could not, I think, be more compelling or insistent to the eye of a university population. Now, on the basis of the title alone, would not our professional loyalties, or just the immensely heated discussion the book has stimulated for more than a year, would that not almost force us to read it, or at least a chapter or two? Now, please, don't misunderstand. Without being either patronizing or prescriptive, I plead not to be either, I just wonder aloud, don't answer, raise your hand, how many have even sampled that book? I realize it is not required reading. I also realize its scope doesn't fall neatly into a department. Indeed, the writer may have a background and behavior that do not square with BYU's at all. Best of all, I realize that one might well argue against the book at least as vigorously as one might argue for it. But how are we to know? Great Scott, you and I are accused in a runaway bestseller of closing minds, failing democracy, and impoverishing souls. Those are terrible indictments, hardly things you'd write home about to the folks. People have been pouring into bookstores in unprecedented numbers to watch one man slap, for all intents and purposes, every university in the nation with a gigantic slab of tuna. What are we to do? Hunker down deeper into the departments? I wonder. The author says the book is a meditation on the state of our soul. Does he succeed? Is, as he says, the crisis in the university the profoundest crisis the modern world faces? Why? What of his argument that the U.S. Constitution was something more of a moral order than of actual rules of government? What does he mean when he says, nature is the standard by which we must judge our lives? Isn't the natural man an enemy to God? Does he believe science can or cannot deal with issues of the good? Is every Frenchman, and perhaps every human being born anywhere, born either Cartesian or Pascalian? And why on earth would it matter? Or what of his principal tension in the book, that of freedom versus openness? Do such distinctions amount to anything? How does he feel about the home and family? Would Latter-day Saints agree or disagree? Is watching a PBS program the high tide of American intellectual life? That's his quote. How does he feel about psychologists and psychoanalysis? Do they rank higher or lower than economists and economics? Does he have the slightest idea what he's talking about in either field? What distinctions, pro or con, does he give to phrases like moral instinct, moral reasoning, moral training, moral education, and moral action? He uses them all. Why does he say it's easier to grasp the condition of a student's soul in the Louvre than in any university classroom? How so? Is our critic for or against more movies about Sir Thomas More and Mohandas Gandhi or less? What course at the university does he think is most likely to give a student, quote, the lasting image of a perfect soul, close quote? Or what does he speak, or of what does he speak, when he quotes Saul Bellow saying, it's a kind of a ghost town into which anyone can move and immediately declare himself sheriff? What role does music play in what the author calls the one regularly recognizable distinction between the educated and uneducated in America? What's the unique significance the author gives to the word modesty? And how does it reflect on a fictional character like Anna Karenina or a real one like St. Augustine? Is it, in fact, any big deal that America has never had to either kill a king or overthrow a church? Well, enough of all of that. Okay, so we're not particularly interested in this book. Maybe we don't need to be. Certainly isn't the lost 116 pages of Book of Mormon manuscript. And no one needs to tell me how precious time is. Choices are inevitable. But I think how wonderful it would be if, as a true community, we all read something together and talked about it. Something broad and provocative and fun, building always on the foundation of our own revelations. If Bloom is too far down the alphabet, I'll settle for Aeschylus. I think it would be absolutely delightful if every person in this room would read tonight, this very night, Prometheus Bound, Agamemnon, and the Seven Against Thebes. That's all of 42 pages. Shouldn't take us more than a couple of campaign speeches to do it. And then over a paintbrush or a pizza or a pair of pinking shears, wherever we gather on this campus, we could discuss them, gospel insights and all. That sounds more fun to me than George Bush and Michael Dukakis meeting face-to-face at a charisma clinic. We might cultivate that larger sense of connectedness and community here. I want to. I do worry about faculty, staff, and administrative segmentation that keeps us from being a full-fledged school in Zion. Fortunately, those aspirations I spoke of earlier work in our favor, because the ennobling climb toward an Everest allows us, indeed it requires us, to take the high ground. It gives us a place for a broader, more liberating, more eternal general education, if you will, which is so fundamental to the growth of the human mind and the development of the human soul, of which Joseph Smith and Brigham Young and every other prophet has spoken. That is the real merging we someday have to do here. Not only organizing and pruning and prioritizing the world's knowledge after we've gathered it and after we've gathered ourselves, but also fusing gospel insight and gospel perspective into every field and discipline of study. That's the excitement of intellectual life at Brigham Young University, at least part of it, at least fundamental to it. One faculty member recently wrote me saying, "We need, without arrogance but with energy and daring, to try to integrate faith and scholarship in our writing and in our teaching, to improve it until it stands on its own merit. We need to stop apologizing for that," he says. "We especially need to get over merely trying to imitate others or win their approval. Too many here are still worrying whether what they write or say will pass the judgment of blank," and I will not say the name of the school, "of all places," end of quote. It isn't the end of the quote, one more paragraph. "We ought," he concludes, "to more fully find a way, a unique way, to combine the best of traditional scholarship with the religious and moral questions of our day, and perspectives that are intrinsic to that scholarship and to the restored gospel. That ought to be an avocation," he concludes. "but a central part of our work at Brigham Young University." Well, the echo of President Kimball's inaugural charge was in the air as I read that. "You must do many things here that are done elsewhere, but you must do them better. Your light must have a special glow." I would quickly note that some disciplines probably lend themselves more directly to gospel insights and influence than others. So please spare me the sometimes sardonic questions as to whether there's a Mormon mathematics or a consecrated chemistry. There probably isn't. But I would say that there are Mormon mathematicians and consecrated chemists and endowed engineers and historians who are high priests. That should be an advantage in our integration of the truth. I am making an unabashed appeal for a distinctly LDS approach to what we too often, too casually call general education, an approach best featured on this campus by our present university-wide efforts in religion, honors, and indeed the general education program itself. Now, I do not want my next statement understood. Please. Okay, do I have your attention? I do not believe that Brigham Young University, at least with current policies on both funding and mission, will or ever should aspire to be a great research university. I put that in quotation marks. At least as the nation defines research universities. I do believe, however, with all my heart, that we should aspire to become the finest undergraduate university on the face of the planet. Now, the misunderstanding I don't want is a knee-jerk, unwarranted assumption that we will therefore have no serious scholarship required of us, nor have a significant, albeit careful, selection of graduate and professional programs. I did not say we would be a four-year college. I said we would be a university. But we will never, I think, be an MIT or a Caltech, nor should we. However, to be a world-class undergraduate teaching university, we have to be a lot smarter and a lot better than we are now. For the purposes of an absolutely unequaled liberal arts general education and combined linked fundamental religious education with it, we have to have teachers who investigate and integrate and know. who are ambitious about godly growth, what Joseph Smith would call enlargement. We have to have teachers who are growing in precisely the same manner we expect students to grow, and that means significant scholarship. In this day and age, with books like Bloom's and Boyer's and Hirsch's and a spate of others lamenting the state of public education and laying the blame squarely at the feet of the universities and often their colleges of education who train and place teachers in those public schools, isn't there something here that BYU can uniquely do? Some way we not only can stand, but stand and shine, to use John Masefield's description of a true university? Don't we have the advantage and the duty to step forward and rally the whole country in this time of national challenge? If BYU is to lend something unique to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in this dispensation, something we can do that makes us a city set on a hill, a light that cannot be hid, wouldn't it be to produce just such an unequaled and unfragmented and undivided school in Zion? To be known as the place where one can obtain a grand, consummate, unparalleled and integrated undergraduate education with whatever other graduate and professional programs we can afford is a reputation I confess to coveting. That is the mission we wrote for BYU 8 years ago, and it is our mission still. Then why aren't we doing better than we are? Well, in many ways we are doing very well. I suppose in some ways we're doing superbly. I'm thrilled, for example, with the increasingly vigorous contributions in religious education. Our colleagues there have developed a strong core curriculum founded on the standard works. They've been very diligent in not letting it get watered down. They have a truly dramatic array of symposia and publications coming out of the Religious Studies Center, and perhaps most gratifying of all, have designed an absolutely scintillating Book of Mormon seminar for transfer faculty who teach that course. A whole fistful of our very finest faculty have written to tell me that this seminar for them across campus ranks among the most stimulating and rewarding faculty experiences they have ever had in just this manner of integration and wholeness and concentration. That is wonderful news to me, to religious education, to Commissioner Cameron, to the students who take the classes, and to the integrating general education climate on our campus. Indeed, our 14 hours of religious education ought to be seen at the very heart of our general education experience. That's why it is not a college of religion. It is fundamental to the university work. I have always viewed it that way in the 14 years I've been an administrator at BYU. I commend and applaud all those who've now over many years have helped and are helping to make that happen. Now, as for honors and general education programs themselves, I consider them to be the crown jewels of the BYU effort in that contribution that we can make, building on our religious heritage, that unique intellectual and academic contribution that we can make to the world of higher education. A great deal that is very exciting to me is happening in these university-wide programs, and more will be happening. Our sisterhood and our brotherhood and our gospel-based goodwill here give us a distinct GE advantage at BYU in our ability to cross disciplinary and departmental lines. We simply have a very muscular leg up on the rest of the academic world in that way. We must seize that advantage. Now, having focused for several years primarily on structural arrangements, curricular issues, winning faculty support, all of which have been done magnificently, by the way, we are now free, it seems to me, to continue to pursue informed, inspired, liberating education itself. To do so, we must organize, encourage, and evaluate and reward good teaching. You will have noted that in addition to our Alcuin Awards, we have recently awarded professorships to some strong scholar teachers who've made a major commitment to undergraduate education. I've announced today the creation of a Distinguished Teacher Award to be one of the university's two highest faculty honors. Exciting, demanding, stretching, challenging, well-organized, and well-taught courses are at the heart of what we do here. No amount of structural fussing or regulatory tinkering will compensate for stale, sterile lectures. In the curriculum, we must constantly resist that centrifugal force that habitually plagues general education programs. We must target our limited resources on a relatively small number of very significant offerings. Furthermore, we need to guard carefully against the tendency to let general education offerings become merely introductory courses to a discipline. They simply must remain more universal than that. May I suggest that we also have to do a better job of communicating the very practical value of general education to our students and to the public. I think it is very important for us not to create an unnecessary cleavage between the world of the academy and the world of work, especially in the minds of tuition-paying parents and higher education's increasing number of critics. We need to do a better job of showing the crucial link between general education and one's vocation. Quote, "If members of a democracy are to be effective contributors to the community," writes Professor Stephen Kahn, "each should be provided with the necessary skills, social orientation, and intellectual perspective to succeed in some field of occupational endeavor. But such true vocational education must not be confused with narrow job training. Animals are broken in and trained. Human beings ought to be enlightened and educated. An individual trained but not educated is unable to adjust in the face of changing conditions and is thus stymied in a world of flux." Sidney Hook adds, "There is a paradox connected with vocational training. The more vocational it is, the less likely it is to provide an actual living. Therefore, broadened vocational preparation is not only of use to the future worker himself, its benefit to society is apparent to anyone who has ever been forced to deal with the mechanized mind of a bureaucrat." Close quote. As Professor Doug Tobler once said to me, "A good general education is the most practical thing I know. How to use the mind may be the ultimate vocational skill." Lastly, across the breadth of our university effort, we must respect and elevate the status of the students themselves. They must be seen as more than what Henry Rosofsky called at Harvard the lumpen proletariat. She is someone's absolutely perfect daughter. He is someone's precious son. And they are certainly all our brothers and our sisters. Furthermore, they're coming to us better prepared than ever before. So we need to expect more of them and more of ourselves while they are here. Mission-like, we need to make this the best 4 years of their life. We need to give them personal attention and treat them with great respect, not only in class, but in administrative and staff contexts as well. We need to advise them thoughtfully and mentor them professionally as an earlier generation of educators used to do. That may be difficult with some of our larger classes and challenging student-teacher ratios, but a good experience in a large class surely beats a bad experience in a small one. I speak from some personal experience. I have always loved Elder Marion D. Hanks, who will be with us tomorrow night, by the way. I've loved his telling of the John Trebonius story. John Trebonius used to take off his hat upon entering the classroom when it was the Germanic custom of the day for professors to keep them on. When asked why he was so needlessly kind to his pupils, he replied, "These little boys will someday be men, and I do not know but that there sits among them one who will change the destiny of mankind. So I take off my hat in deference to what they may become." Close quote. Sitting in his classroom, watching the ways of that gentleman, was the young and future Martin Luther. For today, a last reason for a school in Zion. It is essentially a symbolic one, touched on by pleasant coincidence by Commissioner Cameron. But it's a symbol with genuine substance. Elder John A. Widstow once wrote, "The whole of life is education." Sounds like Brigham Young or any other prophet. No wonder, therefore, that in the correct philosophy of life, schools and other devices for the training of man's powers are foremost. Education is and must be carried onward fully and abundantly in the Church of Christ. This line, "The support of education is indeed one test of the true church." Close quote. That is a stunning affirmation and assertion regarding our earlier comments about the LDS doctrine of learning. But what happens in the world Commissioner Cameron has just described? What happens when the true church grows so large and has such call upon its resources that it can perhaps support only the idea, only the concept of education, rather than the actual schools in which to provide it? In such a time of growth and need, could not the one true church profit magnificently from at least one gleaming evidence of the church's, quote, support of education, close quote? One university sparkling, however distantly, for those saints who now cluster locally with a somewhat altered sense of gathering than Zion once had. Could not BYU then, both symbolically and substantially, be an unparalleled, incomparable blessing to every one of those saints from Nigeria to Newfoundland who may never, ever set foot on BYU soil, let alone dream of having one of their own? Could it not be a house of hope and glory to every member of this church everywhere who is trying to grow, trying to learn, trying to be strong and safe and spiritual in a very secular world? I would surely hope so. We could, for the whole church, provide what the Doughboys called pride in the outfit. And we could provide for them an increasing array of leadership, example, service, and protection in the process. Now, without deifying him prematurely, consider what our own Hugh Nibley has done to strengthen people far, far away from the Provo, from which he seldom travels. And consider, if you will, his fairly biting indictment of some of the rest of us as he praises the university's namesake. "We're only too glad to settle for the outward show, the easy and flattering forms, trappings, and ceremonies of education. And as a result, whenever we move out of our tiny, busy orbits of administration," boy, that hurts, "and display, we find ourselves in a terrifying vacuum." Terrifying, Hugh says, only because we might be found out. But that's just the trouble. Having defaulted drastically in terms of President Young's instructions, some of us stand as a brainless giant, a pushover for any smart kid or cultist or faddist or crank who even pretends to have read a few books. We stand helplessly and foolishly by, dangling our bonnet and plume, while hundreds of students and missionaries, hundreds of members and enemies of the church alike, presume to challenge and then reject the teachings of Joseph Smith on evidence so flimsy that no half-educated person would give it a second thought. No one has ever told them what it means to lay a proper foundation essential to any serious discussion of the things they treat so glibly and triumphantly. Now, continuing and concluding the quote, "Whether we like it or not, we are going to have to return to Brigham Young's ideals of education. We may fight it all the way, but in the end, God will keep us after school until we learn our lessons. And defending the faith intelligently and persuasively is only one kind of aid we might offer. Might be the most important kind, but it's only one. There are, it seems to me, scores of other kinds of help we can give in virtually every discipline of the university. And it will not require our physically going to them or physically bringing them here to us. We can't do very much of either of those. So in most cases, it means writing. Please, please, may we never, ever separate writing from teaching at this university. Let me close by returning to that original school in Zion, and in doing so come full circle. Thank you for indulging a slightly extended meeting. To do that, I have to go past Nauvoo and Kirtland and past Palmyra to the upper room just moments before Gethsemane and Golgotha. As part of the strengthening preparation the Savior provided for his apostles who did not and could not comprehend what lay immediately ahead of them, Christ rose from that paschal meal and, girding himself with a towel, poured water into a basin. He then knelt alone and washed the feet of the 12. There is, of course, a profound gesture of humility and love in this act on the very face of it. During what would be the most anguished evening in human history, when someone might well have attended him a bit more, the Prince of Peace knelt serving others, leaving an unforgettable lesson on the real meaning of the word master. But there was something else going on in the performance of that ordinance, hinted at when Peter tried to resist the Lord's selflessness. "Thou shalt never wash my feet," he recoiled. To which Jesus simply replied, "If I wash thee not, thou hast no part with me." And of course, then marvelous Peter pleads, "Lord, not then my feet only, but also my head, my hands and my head." "If I wash thee not, thou hast no part with me." What could that possibly have to do with schools and education and learning? Maybe everything. As the Lord issued the commandment to organize the school of the prophets, he prefaced it with what Commissioner Cameron has noted may well have been the first of these worthiness interviews that are still a part of the BYU tradition for faculty, staff, administrators, and students. "You must sanctify yourselves," the Lord said. "Yea, purify your hearts and cleanse your hands and your feet before me, that I may make you clean." No one was to be in this apostolic academy unworthily. "You shall not receive any among you into this school, save he is clean from the blood of this generation. And he shall be received by the ordinance of the washing of feet. For unto this end was the ordinance of the washing of feet instituted." Close quote, section 88. Commenting on that experience, the prophet Joseph said, quote, "We have not desired as much from the hand of the Lord through faith and obedience as we ought to have done. Think of aiming too low. We must call our solemn assembly as the Lord has commanded us to do, that we may be able to accomplish His great work, and it must be done in God's own way. Now remember, He's speaking at least in part of an educational work. This is the school of the prophets. It is united, it is calculated to unite our hearts that we may be one in feeling and sentiment. It is calculated to unite our hearts that we may be one in feeling and sentiment, that our faith may be strong, so that Satan cannot overthrow us nor have any power over us here. Close quote. Gathering, uniting, learning, community, cleanliness, communion, one in feeling and sentiment and purpose, a basin, a circle, a bond. Humility and service, strong faith and order, the house of the Lord, a school. Why have a temple of learning? How dare I ask? How dare I ask? And may God forgive me until I do what I'm supposed to do, and what you may not be able to do until I do, that there indeed can, in fact, be a school in Zion. Why? In the dark of the night or the middle of the day? Why? I'll tell you why. So that Satan cannot overthrow us, nor have any power over us here. The glory of God is intelligence, or in other words, light and truth. And light and truth forsake that evil one. God bless us that it may be so. Some way, somehow, someday in Provo, Utah. Perhaps the last of the schools in Zion. In the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.